I was thinking about it. You know, one way or another, we all find ourselves in the wilderness eventually. Personally, I wouldn't wish my own experience of the wilderness on my worst enemy. It was a place of extreme disorientation and confusion, of depression and doubt so deep that it pushed me to the limits of my belief. It was a painful time, and I would never, ever hope for someone to have to experience what I did. But at the same time, neither would I ever, ever trade it away. That was the paradox of the wilderness for me. The wilderness, more than anything else in my spiritual life, has made me who I am today as a spiritual individual and even as a minister. It was in that place, in what at that point felt like a God's near absence, and in the darkness of my own doubt, that I found not just a more stable spirituality, but more importantly, a deeper compassion for humanity. The wilderness has a long and storied place in spiritual histories. It goes by many, many different names. St. John of the Cross termed it the dark night of the soul. Mother Teresa experienced the wilderness so profoundly that when she began praying, as she normally would pray to Jesus, she began instead praying to the absent one. The monks and mystics have always sought out the desert as a holy place. You know, increasingly, living in the U.S. can feel like a wilderness adventure. For many people in the U.S., life has definitely become a constant struggle for survival. I'm not suggesting that we should look on those as opportunities to grow spiritually. I'm suggesting that in those kinds of times, we all need something to help pull us through. That we need something to help us, upright us when we feel like we may be going under. In his novel 1984, George Orwell paints a picture of a dystopian wilderness. He imagines what the world would be like in control of authoritarian regimes. In his world, Big Brother controls everything, where people live, what they do, where they work, what they say, even how they think. Thought crime, to think thoughts that are against the ideology of the party, is a heinous wrong in that world. Now, the central character in Orwell's book is a man named Winston, and he works at the Ministry of Truth, rewriting history so that it fits with Big Brother's view of the world. Nowadays, the powers that be would just label the inconvenient facts as fake news and replace them with their alternate facts. Winston despises what he does, and he despises the regime that makes him do that work. So, he sort of begins rebelling in these small acts of defiance, and he even finds this little alcove in his house where the cameras of Big Brother can't quite spot him, and he begins this illicit affair with a woman named Julia. And in his own thoughts, he questions the way the world is. And as each small act of rebellion occurs, the likelihood that Winston will be caught, it increases. Now, the tension rises until the fateful moment when Winston and his resistance is exposed. And he's sent to prison to be rehabilitated, which meant breaking him emotionally and physically and then turning him back into a party drone. Now, his interrogator is a gentleman by the name of O'Brien. And he wants to convince Winston that resistance is futile. The party will never be defeated, that the presence will stretch into the future in an unending march. And at one point, O'Brien chillingly says to Winston, "If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stomping on the human face forever. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stomping on the human face forever. It's a depressing image. A lifetime of wilderness. Well, throughout spiritual texts the world over, the dystopian future painted by Orwell's book, and in so much of even popular literature today, the times that Orwell was pointing to in old spiritual writings are represented by wildernesses. In those times, the hopelessness that we point to in our modern stories of a dystopian future, well, in those times, they were captured in stories about wilderness. They are places that are vast and confusing and often full of death, or at least the threat of death. And in those stories, wildernesses are difficult and sometimes scary places. They're full of threats, including the threat of death. But typically, they are never an end. They do not extend into the future. Typically, they are sources of revelation. The Quran, for example, was said to be revealed to Muhammad as he sat in a cave in the wilderness. So yes, frequently they are mostly, if not entirely, difficult revelations, but they are important. And sometimes, some of the greatest movements and changes in the lives of spiritual characters come in being in the wilderness and surviving. So, the intriguing question for me is, what survival skills, what tools do we need to survive these difficult and trying places? It occurs to me that in this increasingly divided nation, with firearm deaths on the rise, a disappearing middle class, in a land where 1 in 7 people face hunger over the course of a year, with so many things that can make this nation feel like a new version of the wilderness, it occurs to me survival skills for the wilderness seem to be a very worthwhile, not to mention timely, investigation. So, I'd like to start with a story. In 1979, a tugboat, the tugboat Cahaba, was headed down the Tombigbee River in Alabama. Now, the current was flowing really fast, and the tug's pilot approached a bridge and where he was supposed to release his coal barges. So, he put his 1,800 horsepower twin engines into reverse and dropped them, and then he put them into reverse to get away. But when the boat moves, he moves slightly off course, and the current banged into the side of it and swung the boat sideways and slammed it into the bridge. Now, the current was so strong at that point that it forced the boat to go underwater. To the astonishment of the onlookers, it went underwater, passed under the bridge, and popped up on the other side with the pilot still at the wheel. Now, why did it come back to surface in an upright position? Well, because it was ballasted with a 3-foot thick lining of cement on the bottom of its hull. A vivid reminder that life can often go horribly wrong, but if we have the right ballast, we can get through it and emerge upright on the other side. One of the clear spiritual wilderness stories, one of the messages of wilderness stories, one that might ring somewhat overly simplistic to our ears, but one of the messages of those wilderness stories has traditionally been that folks who survive the wilderness ultimately do so by not giving up on their higher power. They are ballasted by their belief system. They are ballasted, sturdied by the recognition, the understanding that their God is with them. they are not alone. Now, as I said, that may seem a bit simplistic and even a little bit sentimental to us. But I will say, when you've been in the dark depths of the murky wilderness, having something to hold on to, something to steady you, is one of the most important things. Through many more experiences than I would have ever thought could have happened in my life, I have to say, it almost doesn't matter what that thing is. Real or imagined, you need something to be the light at the end of the tunnel. And if it can also help you not feel alone, well, then even better. Now, I'm not saying having that thing to hold on to during difficult times will solve your problems. I'm just saying it can lighten the load a bit. I'm not saying that the wilderness, the tough times will magically disappear. I'm just saying it has a tendency to help you see the light a little more clearly, even in the midst of the darkness. Like the tugboat Cahaba, if we hope to survive the difficult places and spaces that life always brings, it's helpful to be well ballasted, to have some form of hope to hold on to. And that brings me actually to a second story I'd like to share. Former U.S. President Richard Nixon is infamous, obviously, for his place at the center of the Watergate scandal. He disgraced both the office of the President of the United States and the United States itself in the eyes of the world. When Hubert Humphrey, a former U.S. Vice President, died, Nixon attended his funeral. Dignitaries came from all over the country, from all over the world. Yet Nixon was made to feel decidedly unwelcome there. People actually turned their eyes away and conversations immediately ran dry when he approached. Nixon could just feel the ostracism being laid out to him. Then Jimmy Carter, the serving U.S. president, walked into the room. Carter, being from a completely different political party than Nixon and well known for, you know, honesty, his integrity, as he moved to his seat, President Carter noticed Nixon standing all alone. Carter immediately changed his course. He walked over to Nixon. He held out his hand and genuinely and broadly embraced Nixon and said, "Welcome home, Mr. President. Welcome home." The incident was reported by Newsweek magazine, which wrote, "If there was a turning point in Nixon's long ordeal in the wilderness, it was that moment and that gesture of love and compassion." Carter gifted Nixon with love and compassion. Nixon certainly had done nothing to deserve it from him. It was an act of pure grace on Carter's part. I think that may be the second part of what helps us through wildernesses. Each other. More precisely, shared love and compassion between each other. Not because we feel like someone has earned it or deserved it, but because we all need it. Because we are all called to it. Because when properly shared, it puts an end to our wilderness. The question that we should ask ourselves is, how well do I do at playing the role of being a hope bringer, of being a love bringer, of being compassionate when I see folks in the wilderness? When we see Nixon standing there in the corner, as far as the world is concerned, a person deserving of our judgment and frankly a person we would be justified in treating somewhat poorly, at least ignoring, do we leave that person there in their own personal wilderness? Or do we do the unexpected? The somewhat illogical and altogether loving and compassionate thing and embrace them saying, welcome home. I'm definitely not saying, in spite of what parts of this may have sounded like, that our nation has become one big wilderness. Not at all. At times our nation actually sounds like a giant, feels like a giant playground. But we do go through tough times. Some of them created by the very people we have elected. And because of it, I would argue that it is important that we are all well ballasted. It's important that we realize we are not alone. And not just because of a belief in a higher power, but you are not alone because you have this spiritual community. These people here, and all of those people who love and care for you. For all of us, life is full of wildernesses. The death of family and friends, loss of a job, health issues, major life changes. I could go on and on. The most important ballast for all of us in those wildernesses is each other. More specifically, the way that we share and represent love and compassion to one another. Even when we feel like maybe the other person doesn't quite deserve it. Because it isn't all about deserving it. It's about needing it. And we all need it.